Hey friends, welcome to the Fundraising Leadership Podcast with Margaret Katzcan and your intrepid warrior, David Land Julie. Hey, Margaret.
Hey, David. So David and I were talking before we hit record, and I think there are a few things in our space. So, and I'll get to what those are, but we chose a topic today that's, that doesn't get talked about very much. So
Right. It's true. So we're going to talk about it.
we're going to talk about it, and the topic is that is dying and grieving. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
Like
Topics.
when like when the Grim Reaper comes knocking at the door of a family member or a friend of yours. Not necessarily when the Grim Reaper comes knocking for you. That would probably be another topic for another podcast, but this may be an on-ramp to
Yeah.
that
And just maybe about an hour ago, I got a notification that somebody who I care quite a bit about, and she has been on a journey with pancreatic cancer for about 18 months, which is, I understand, a pretty long time, honestly, to dance with that disease. But she passed away yesterday, and I just learned of that. So I am feeling the loss of her, but also the inspiration. She was courageous in her. She talked about dying. She really got very intentional about what it meant and how she wanted to spend her time, and doubling down on her sense of spirituality. And there may have been 3 a.m. moments for her that we didn't get to witness, of terror and dread, but the part of her that she shared was an inspiration in a strange way. So I feel sad and also touched by following her through this journey.
Well, it sounds like she was a great example for all of us. And who knows how we will respond and react when we get our diagnosis or when we are confronted by the reality of, our time on the face of this earth is limited. And by the
Yeah.
way, it's limited for all of us. It's just a question of when and how. But
Yes.
when you know, I mean, this is some of the inner work that many people don't do in life, that would prepare them for this eventuality, or prepare you as it has prepared you, Margaret, to be with the grief of someone close to you who has passed. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'd love to get to grief in a moment, but I wanted to respond to something that you just said, which is, I think, David, both of us have had the experience of having somebody very close to us kicking and screaming as they
Yes.
head into this process. Just, so much
Yes.
resistance, and I don't want to judge that for the person. I think we all do our best, but the impact of that is big. Right, being
Right.
around
Well, so
somebody.
there's the kicking and screaming version, which you and I have experienced. There's the complete acceptance and surrender, which sounds like your friend, and certainly my father, that I witnessed. And then there's another version of this called avoid, which we won't name names here, but I've been a witness to the absolute avoidance of dealing with what's eventually coming.
I
Yeah.
also have witnessed that, and each of these ways of being with death, really, I think it has impact on how you grieve and how you make sense of losing somebody, right? I mean, there's the person who is dying and how they handle it. Again, with the benefit of the doubt, I imagine that everybody does the best they can. Hard stop,
Yes.
right? Like, I don't think
Yeah.
there's changing any of that, but I'm just speaking to the texture of grief is very different when you are here to grieve the person who's just died, depending on how they went into this process.
Well, my as you're saying that, I'm reflecting upon the kicking and free kicking and screaming version, which creates suffering for the person who's dying, but it also creates suffering for other people around them. Or at least pain, at least some pain, but it also caused for me some suffering because it really I was I had the aspiration that there would be more acceptance and peace, and it just wasn't there till the very, very end.
And I think in our nervous systems, when we are witnessing or caring about or holding this journey for somebody in our lives who's kicking and screaming, they feel regret. And I say that with a question mark. I don't know 100% what it is that they are feeling, not ready to die. They want more time. There's a resistance and that I think really pings us and creates all of this sadness of like, wow, this person was so not prepared or ready or peaceful about this. It creates extra noise and static that is like hard. It's hard to be with.
It
This is
is.
not, it's not how I want to be. It is not how I
No,
would like to
actually, you're
experience
pointing
this.
to something that, we said this podcast wasn't about how we prepare, but in I would say what's coming up for me is that our experiences, these three different ways of dealing with it, actually reminds me and the audience, like, if there's one thing you want to prepare for in your life, is the eventual end of your life.
It is, in fact, inevitable.
Is inevitable, and it's the one thing that many, many people in our culture do not, we have all this planning and organizing, and yet people are reluctant to prepare themselves for this.
And I think that's a great segue to this topic of grief, because I think when we fight our own grief, I think that makes the idea of dying far, far worse when we have not been able to surrender to our own grief for things in our own lives, for the death of people that we cared about, pets, any of those kinds of things. When we shortchange grief, which as a culture, we're no good at grieving. I feel like we really we don't encourage it in the ways that I think would be healthier for us.
Well, as we say in our positive intelligence coaching program, grief is one of those emotions that can linger for a very long time, if you allow it, unless you just avoid it completely, which is a way you sabotage yourself and your emotional health. It's like, oh, I'm just going to push it down or avoid it or not deal with it. And yet, that has a toll also.
It has a huge toll. I think if we spend our whole lives being afraid of loss, losing people in the grief, and we give ourselves a story that it's not survivable, we're not going to be okay, then I don't think we love people as much as we wish we would, as we are capable of.
Well, I can share my own observation of my father, who was completely devastated by the suicide of my sister. And yet he never really grieved. He stuffed it down. And in my opinion, I have no scientific evidence for this, so this is just an opinion. His systemic cancer that emerged 10 or so, 10 or 20 years later was a, I could probably just draw a straight line between that event, his unwillingness to really deal with the impact, the emotion surrounding that, and stuffing it down, which is one way of dealing with it, but it has an impact on your body. If we've learned anything from science, we know that emotions are part of who we are as human beings, and if we don't process them, they get stuck in our body in some way that can be unhealthy at times.
And I know there is emerging science about that, and I feel like, you know what you know, right? I mean, until proven otherwise. But what
Correct.
I'm also curious about is the emotional impact on you. Like, how did your dad, do you remember a moment? I mean, this is not the right way for me to phrase this question. I'm making up that there was a moment in time and there was like the before version and the after version of your dad. And how he related with you, or how much love he was able to let flow, that you probably did clock.
A good observation. You and I have talked about this frequently. It's I would say that in many respects he might have closed down emotionally toward me and my other sister, but certainly I saw a lot of I will say with my mom, he demonstrated a lot of love and caring for sure. I suspect also, well, who knows? All I know is like the impact on me at that time, not his impact, but the impact of that event. So, we talked about these three ways. There may be many more ways of dealing with the grief surrounding a death of a close friend or family member. But my mechanism for coping at that time was complete avoidance. I just avoided it. I avoided fear. I think like the
And
initial
then the
shock.
question, David, how'd that go for you?
I was up until about 10 years ago. First of all, I never spoke about my sister's suicide with anybody for 30 years. Yeah, never, never spoke about that. I mean, you and I have been through the same leadership development program where some of the focus, a significant part of the focus is around the emotional field of leadership. And that cracked me open. So I'm thankful for that. And it was in that room with about two dozen other people that I shared that my sister had committed suicide. Now, that's like coming out. And I had a really deep cry. So anyway, the impact of that for me was complete avoidance, like stepped over it, never talked about it. It was rarely ever discussed, other than like when my father would say a prayer at Christmas, he'd say something like, "And let's remember those who are not able to be with us today." Like, again, like a total avoidance.
Right. Like he didn't even name your
Right?
sister. He
No,
didn't
not at
name your
all.
sister.
Nope, never, never, never. I will say later in life, and I think, again, as a consequence of the training that we've received and some of the work we do with clients now, I was able to bring up my sister time and time again with my father, and we were able to, and my mother, and we were able to, reflect and recollect and, not necessarily talking about the event, which was traumatic for all of us, which is another whole topic of the impact of someone dying who's close to you, a friend. There's trauma. There's trauma, which is some of the work we do as coaches. Or you go get therapy like my mom did, which was, God bless her. My mom was like in therapy. My father would never go, but she went, I don't know, for like 1 or 2 years. Amazing.
David, as you're talking, I'm not sure. I mean, I have understood in my system. So my father, who passed away at the end of October, also lost a sibling when he was in his 20s. He lost his little brother, who was hit by a drunk driver on the side of the road. So, but I mean, it wasn't a suicide, but it was equally shocking. It, I'm sure, had different layers, but and I never saw him cry, and he barely ever talked about his brother. And I understood, like, for my, it happened, I believe that my mother was pregnant with me, so I was not alive when it happened, but it's sort of part of the fabric of trauma in the family. But I don't think my dad ever did a lot of grieving. I wasn't there, so I can't say for sure, but I do wonder, because he also was spent several years leading up to the end of his life kicking and screaming and not wanting to have his life be over. And he, you know, his way of doing that was like to create chaos, you know, to like generate something, right? Like, he couldn't get himself on a plane and do an impulsive vacation or have a big fancy meal. So he was looking for ways to still have relevance and impact, like a kid throwing a rock into the lake, you know, and watching the ripples. And so he just found ways to create chaos with, you know, lack of planning and lack of talking about things. But I do wonder, as we're talking about this, what might have been the relationship for him between, you know, that, did I ever see my dad cry? Maybe at his mom's funeral, like two or three tears, but I don't, like, not right until the end. The last year he did some crying finally, but I
Never
hadn't
saw my
really.
father. Never saw my father cry.
Yeah.
Yeah, even at the wakes for my sister, the funeral, I never saw him cry. Never. He would not let that happen.
Think people believe that if they start crying, like, the dam's going to break and they're not going to be able to stop themselves. Like, they're going to cry for the rest of their lives. I really do believe in, so they hold it in, especially for men. There's not a lot of permission.
Permission. Certainly, I have, as a sensitive person, I was not aware of my sensitivity until more recently, and you know, feeling my, as you say, feeling my feels maybe a bit more strongly than other people or. You know, HSP, highly sensitive person. We have a little bit different, wired a little bit different. You know, the neuroscience of this is becoming pretty well documented now. Just a different kind of nervous system. Yeah, I don't know. There was a lot of permission in my leadership tribe for being able to express that. Grief and cry, you know, in the presence of others and without being judged.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I've never, well, for most of my life, I wasn't a public crier. Like, I hated crying in front of other people. And I think
Yeah.
I did a program called the Hoffman Institute process, the Hoffman process. And I started crying and pretty much cried for a week. People came up to me after and said, God, I'm kind of jealous. Like, I wish that I could cry. It seems like it would feel really good, you know, like just to get it out. And that was a big pivot point for me. Now I cry all the time, and in front of whoever, I just don't seem to be able to stop it.
That you know that it's bringing up a memory for me now. I remember third grade. School was always very tough for me, right? Through graduate school. It was just, know, 14 years of torture. I have no idea why I put myself through this, right? And I'm so glad to see parents making other choices for their children where the industrial, you know, the educational industrial complex just doesn't work for them. I was one of those kids, but I managed to get through. But I remember very distinctly in third grade going to public school 108 in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, New York. And there was like a rotating front of the room teacher that year. And, you know, like, a third grader, you're starting to go from me to we, as a person. This is like the adult, they call this like, you know, adult development. So it's in those early years, second grade, third grade, that you go from me to we, and you get attachment to like your teachers in the classroom. This happens, like my wife teaches second grade. These kids are attached to her like nobody's business, right? I just remember sobbing like uncontrollably several times, and then like the new teacher would just literally take my desk and put me in the back corner. That's how it was dealt with. So I think I learned from that. Like, oh, crying in public, you are going to be shamed.
Was that because you were a boy, do you think, or did that
I
happen to
don't,
anybody who cried, or you don't remember?
who knows? Maybe
Who
she just
knows?
what couldn't deal with it, you know? A lot of people don't know how to be with somebody who's crying. It's a whole nother topic of a podcast. Like
That's
how to
true.
be with someone who's having a emotional reaction. Like,
You
how do
feel
you be
like
with someone?
I should be able to fix this,
Yeah.
make it stop. Yeah,
Make it
it's a
stop. So if I put him in the corner, it'll stop. No, I just put my head down on the table and kept crying. You know,
huh.
and I'm sure there's some men, maybe some women in the podcast right now would be like, oh, suck it up, you wimp, right? Okay,
I
well,
don't think so, David. I think that's
that's a
you. That's your
shaming.
judge being
That's a
very
shaming.
unkind.
That's a shaming. Trust me, I've been shamed enough in my life to know that that's very much in the realm of possibility, the way people think about this and react to it. Thankfully, I think we are moving in terms of the level of consciousness in our society. I do feel like you're moving in a direction where we're not shaming and blaming children for, you know, being sad, having an emotional reaction. But literally, I was, you know, I was, it's like bringing up a bit of anger and sadness for me right now, just thinking, like, wow, like what was going on with that person to actually deal with a young boy like that, you know, in a classroom? You see, that's my compassion coming through a little bit too. Something
Yeah.
was going on with her, like she couldn't deal with it, you know.
The compassion for, little third grade David who had a
Yes.
lot of feels and didn't know what to do with them and, that couldn't keep it in, didn't, right? Like just, yeah, that's.
But I would say pretty soon after that, or as a result of that, that got zipped up for a very long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe another couple of incidents where I did cry, but that got zipped up for about, I don't know, 40 years.
And when we can't cry, we can't grieve. And when we can't grieve, it's very hard to be with death. It's very hard to navigate death. I wanted to read if it's okay. Is it okay, David, if I read something?
I think you were prepared to read something. I
I
think it'd be
am.
a
I
great
wanted
way
to
to,
read something a
let's
good friend
be a great way
sent
to
me.
close out the podcast. Yeah.
I'll read it to close out the podcast. A good friend sent me a book right after my father died, and the title of the book, and I'll do a link in the show notes, but it's called The Smell of Rain on Dust, and it's written by somebody named Martine Prechtel, and this is just a little part of the introduction. So grief is not what people feel when they lose what they want, or lose what they want to happen, or when they don't get what they think they deserve. That is disappointment. Not the same at all. Very important not to confuse with grief. Grief is natural. To grieve the loss of what we love is as natural as peeing, eating, singing, dreaming, running, or looking under rocks for bugs to feed your frog. More importantly, grieving is necessary. When there is real loss, grieving should never be avoided or postponed. Grieving is absolutely necessary. Without grief, the world would cease to renew itself. The world would cease to exist. Grief is not a preference for choosing to not have grief when grief is there, is to defer and burden someone else with having to do your grieving. This makes the world a sick place. Grief is an obligation to the life one has been awarded, an obligation to life to make more life. And there's much more in this book, but it was a beautiful, helpful message to me.
It's beautiful. So you'll put a link to that book in the show notes. And look, if you're going through something, close friend has died, a pet has died, a family member has died, and you want to just have a conversation with one of us, please reach out. We're going to put our contact information, a link to our contact information in the show notes. This is part of the work that we do as coaches. It's how we're trained to actually help clients process their emotions.
Yeah, and I'd like to just end with one quick thing, which is when we did our coach training, they said to us, "What you cannot be with runs your life."
That's a good inquiry for you in the audience. Whatever you can't be with runs your life. Take that as an inquiry. What is it that you can't be with?
And how is it running your life?
All right. We'll see you next time.